The Alibi Club by Francine Matthews. Narrated by Ellen Archer. Copyright 2006 by Francine Matthews. This audiobook is published by arrangement with Francine Matthews and the Sagalyn Literary Agency and was produced in the year 2006 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Prologue, March 12, 1940. There were 9 people waiting in the stuffy room that faced the aerodrome's tarmac, 10 if you counted the sleeping child swaddled in a blanket in the Italian girl's arms, 3 women, 6 men, several nationalities, and the brazen churn of propellers beyond the frosted window. Each of the waiting passengers was desperate enough to leave Oslo in the dead of night and dead of winter, so the air hummed with suppressed violence and restlessness and incipient hysteria. No one spoke. Jacques Allier had his back to the wall nearest the door, an evening newspaper grasped in one gloved hand, the other thrust in his pocket. The unheated room was freezing, but his skin was beaded with sweat, and his hidden fingers clutched a gun. The clock read 3 minutes until midnight. The plane would leave at 12:07. Allier's passport had been taken 10 minutes ago and not returned. The man named Demars, who had all his luggage, was inexplicably missing from the aerodrome, and this was only one of the factors contributing to Allier's sweat. He hated to fly. When he'd undertaken this operation, he'd asked for a submarine out of Brest, a destroyer from Ternsberg. He'd gotten an 8-seater with ice on its wings and no guns to speak of. He was praying he'd be allowed to board, although Allier was one of those who could not believe in God. Not now. He was a spare, bland-faced man in the good cloth coat and spectacles of a banker, mid-40s perhaps, clearly European, but shockingly unmilitary for the times. His eyes drifted away from the damning clock. The man Demars was still missing, and roved indifferently over the faces of his fellow passengers. 2 men arguing politics in Dutch. A gawky boy in his teens, his looks feverish, and his hands drumming nervously against the arm of his chair, fingers spilling cigarette ash onto the linoleum floor. A gray-haired woman stolidly eating pickled herring from a waxed paper box furnished by an Oslo shop. None of them spoke. None made eye contact. Only the tall, burly blonde fellow in the impeccable camel hair coat was staring openly, a slight smile curving his lips, at the Italian girl with the sleeping child. And who could blame him? Allier thought irritably. She was exquisite, with her fur collar grazing her faintly flushed cheek, her dark knot of hair shining beneath the arc of her hat. Her fingers were gloved in ostrich skin. The frail hunch of her shoulders might reflect the penetrating cold, or the solicitude that kept her bent, Madonna-like, over the face of her infant. Was she even 20? Her passport and ticket lay on the hard wooden bench beside her. Like Allier, she was bound for Amsterdam in the dead of night. "Turn back," he urged. "Go north. Go west. Go anywhere but home." He had caught one glimpse of her mouth, curved like a G-clef, and her eyes, disconcertingly blue in an olive-skinned face. The blonde hero opposite had glimpsed them, too.
"Madame," the man said gently in Italian. "You look chilled to the bone. Perhaps a cigarette, if I were to light it for you?"
The girl ignored him, failing to so much as lift her head. Allier exulted in this, in the snub offered the blonde hero, who might, from his looks, have been Norwegian or even English, but who Allier knew now was German. A broad-shouldered, perfect German in civilian dress, lounging in the very aerodrome where he, Allier, had elected to escape. This could not be coincidence. This was part of a plan. The fact of the German presence meant that Allier was already a dead man. Demars and the luggage would not be coming. He tossed the folded newspaper into a waste bin and moved casually toward the door leading out to the planes. One of them bound for Perth, the other for Amsterdam. The propellers whined in the cold, the pilots worried about ice. It was possible that they would all be told to go home, to try again tomorrow, and for Allier, there would be the certainty of an armed escort at some point along his route back to the French legation,
A sudden flurried movement into an enemy car, a bullet in the temple, after how many agonizing hours of interrogation. He continued to stare through the waiting room window, his gloved hands clasped behind his back, conscious of movement, some kind of rank closing behind. It was barely 2 weeks since he'd vaulted up the marble steps of the armaments ministry and accepted the fake passport in his mother's maiden name. Freiss. He was Michel Freiss of Salzburg, aged 41, a banker with no interest in this phony war between France and the Germans that had been going on for 7 months now without a shot fired. That night he'd taken the last train across the border, bound for Amsterdam, and then by slow degrees traveled north to Stockholm and finally Oslo. There were 5 days of negotiation in a tiny snowbound town near the Telemark Mountains, ponderous dinners and pledges of eternal friendship and risky flourishes of the French flag. Oblique counsels in the legation, none of the usual diplomats in on the secret, and the lights burning all night in the German intelligence pavilion across the garden wall.
"You're famous," the French ambassador assured him with a twisted smile. "Everybody wants to talk to you. Our people caught this the day you left Paris."
It was a decoded German radio transmission he carelessly handed Allier. At any price, intercept a suspect Frenchman traveling under the name of Freiss. What the ambassador had not bothered to point out was that Allier had been betrayed before he'd boarded the night train to Amsterdam. Who, he asked himself now, a spy in Daughtry's office? Somebody at the bank? The two-beat note of a police siren was audible, suddenly in the distance, insistent, rising, certainly closer. Perhaps it was the lab, one of Joliot's people, or fucking Demar's. He's probably sold the luggage.
"Mr. Freiss," said a voice at his elbow.
He turned, caught the untroubled face of Norwegian border control, a woman neatly uniformed, her clipped hair so fair it might almost be white. She was offering him a bunch of papers, but he ignored her extended hand. The police sirens had pulled up to the aerodrome door, the butt of his gun twisted in his fingers, slippery with sweat. In a matter of seconds, the door would burst open, a clutch of men tripping over themselves in their haste to seize him. He might have time to take one of them down, the big German, perhaps, but there were these women, that child in the Madonna's arms. "Your passport and ticket for Amsterdam," Border Control persisted. "Everything is in order. You may proceed to the tarmac." He glanced over her head and met the German's eyes. The man was still smiling faintly, the same indulgent look he'd turned on the young Italian princess, who was rising now from her seat, magnificent and indifferent. "He's let me run all this way so he could follow my trail," Allier thought. "I'll lead him no further." He took his passport and ticket from the woman's hand and, without a word, held the door wide. The Italian girl flicked him one glance from her arresting blue eyes as she passed. Not even this, Allier thought, was comfort before dying. Then he and the blonde hero followed her into the cold. There was confusion about the planes. A huge black Daimler had driven straight onto the tarmac and thrust itself between them. A man was running distractedly beneath the wings, shouting inaudibly over the clatter of the engines and barely avoiding the propellers. His driver pulled an astonishing number of suitcases from the idling car. The police and their sirens were silent now, beyond the runway gates. It was the Daimler they had escorted through the streets of Oslo, wailing right up to the Amsterdam flight. Allier felt his face flush with heat and his hands clench. This is what hope feels like. Terror and a clenched fist. He recognized the dapper black-haired figure pirouetting beneath the fuselage. He recognized the suitcases. Demar's driver was loading them even now into the belly of the Perth plane. Allier counted them as best he could across the distance and darkness. 13, he thought. Please God, let there be 13. Demar's collided headlong with the German's camel hair coat. Whiskey fumes and cigar smoke wafted through the frigid night air.
"Pardon me, most esteemed sir."
He spoke Norwegian, and he clutched the German's sleeve like a spoiled child.
"Which of these is the Amsterdam plane? Have I missed it? I must at all costs make the Amsterdam plane."
They argued the destination of both flights, the Demmler's right to park in the middle of the tarmac, the abuse of police escort, the advisability of arriving on time. Allier kept walking. He did not look back. The Italian girl boarded the Amsterdam plane with a grimace on her face, the saintly infant now screaming in her arms. Allier's ticket fluttered to the ground. He pulled a second one, stamped for Perth, from his breast pocket. As the Amsterdam pilot taxied toward his takeoff, Allier caught a glimpse of the blonde German under the tarmac lights, hatless, his coat flying back like wings, running hopelessly after the wrong plane. Fog diverted them, as was expected. They landed near dawn in a town Allier had never heard of, somewhere on the east coast of Scotland. A small field, quite deserted, the waiting room windows blacked out with painted canvas. The pilot gave him tea. From politeness, he tried to drink it.
"Did you hear?"
the man asked him.
"The Germans shot down that plane, the one bound for Amsterdam last night."
Allier thought of the young Italian girl, the two men arguing in Dutch, the child that would have been wailing, certainly, as the flames bloomed in the cockpit and the frantic pilot beat them back. The long, tight fall into the North Sea, implacable as a destroyer's hull. He set down the tea.
"What have you got in all those suitcases?" the pilot asked curiously. "The crown jewels of Norway?"
Allier glanced at the man. The truth was a breach of security, but the pilot would never believe him anyway.
"Water," he replied.
Part 1. American Business. Monday, May 13th, 1940. Chapter 1. Later, they would remember that spring as one of the most glorious they'd ever known in Paris. The flowering of peached fruit trees and the scent of lime blossom crushed underfoot, the chestnuts unfurling their leaves in ordered ranks along the Champs-Élysées, the women's silks rustling like wings as they hurried to dinner, all had a perilous sweetness, like absinthe. Sally King, who had lived in the city for nearly 3 years now and might be acknowledged as something of an expert, maintained that even when it rained, Paris was ravishing. The streets shone in the sudden torrents, regardless of grime or automobile petrol or the piss in the open urinals. They glistened with a brilliance that was consumptive and suicidal. She was surging against the tide of people on the Pont Neuf that night, across the narrowest point of the little island that sat like a raft in the middle of the Seine, having already fought her way past the shuttered bookstalls of the Quai de la Tournelle. She did not move swiftly, because the French heels of her evening sandals caught in the cracks between the paving stones. It was dark, blackout dark, and she would have liked a taxi, but there were none to be found. She could sense the panic in the hunched shoulders and too rapid steps of the Parisians, some of whom turned despite their fear and stared at her openly. Sally King, tall and angular, all her beauty in the impossible length of her legs, the clarity of her frame beneath the candy wrapper gown. She had been living among them long enough now to perfect her schoolgirl French, and she understood the spattering of rumor and fear. They've broken through the line. The Boche are through at Sedan. The army is in retreat. The news from the front had blown through the city like a boiling wind, a whisper on the northern outskirts, the report of a friend of a friend. The streets were blazing with half-truths and exaggeration under the deep blue dusk of the shaded lights, and most people were milling south. Sally pushed north, toward the right bank and the exquisite little flat fronting on the Louvre, Philip Stillwell's place. He had left her waiting at a table with a splendid view of Notre Dame, conspicuously alone at La Tour d'Argent, not her favorite restaurant in Paris, but certainly the most expensive. It was unusual for a woman to arrive without an escort, but Gaston Masson, La Tour's manager, was accustomed to the peculiarities of Americans. If the rest of his diners chose to speculate on the cost of Sally's dress, her probable immorality, her purpose in waiting nearly an hour for a man who never showed up, she was at least decorative and hence valuable against the backdrop of the Seine. Her face, with its high cheekbones and too wide smile, was said to be famous. She was freakishly tall. She carried a gas mask case instead of a purse and wore last year's Schiaparelli, an economical gesture in time of war. Shocking pink silk, embroidered with acid green bugs.
"Perhaps Monsieur Stillwell is delayed," Masson observed apologetically. "If the Germans have broken our line, if they have crossed the Meuse, and even now are on the march through Belgium, a lawyer might have much to do."
But not tonight, Sally thought as she picked her way across the ancient bridge. Tonight he was going to ask me to marry him. The note had come at 5 o'clock, hand-delivered by one of Sullivan and Cromwell's messengers, because she had no telephone in her flat in the Latin Quarter. "Sally, dearest, I might be a little late for dinner this evening, as I have an appointment with a member of the firm. Ask Gaston to seat you and order up a bottle of champagne." A lawyer's wife, she thought, would have to adjust to such things. But Philip had never come, and rudeness was unlike him. At the end of the bridge, she hesitated. The darkened bulk of the Louvre loomed on her left. Without its usual blaze of light, the city seemed forlorn and spectral, the people muttering through the streets like an army of the dead. Sally heard an air raid siren shrill and the high-pitched tinkle of breaking glass. A woman sobbed. Gooseflesh rose along her bare arms, and she understood how solitary she was, how vulnerable. She ought to head for a bomb shelter, but nothing had fallen on Paris during the tedious 8 months of phony war, so she squared her shoulders and walked toward Philip. Another woman would have doubted herself, assumed that he hadn't shown because he didn't love her. That simple thought never occurred to Sally. She had mapped Philip's soul quite thoroughly during the long months of the past winter, her job abruptly over, the whole question of her future hanging in the balance. She knew he'd been worried for weeks, and that it had something to do with S&C, with his work at the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. They'd met the previous August. Philip, new to Paris and losing his way on the Rue Cambon, searching for S&C's doors and stumbling instead into the house of Chanel, which sat at number 31. Sally had been descending the famous staircase, Coco's preferred runway, to the admiration of the men and women seated expectantly below. It was Mademoiselle's fall collection, the last collection she would design for years, as it turned out. Sally had worn one of Coco's little black dresses, very chic and timeless in the usual manner. It was Coco who'd made black fashionable when it had always been strictly for mourning. That August the color was disastrous, a presage of Poland's martyrdom, all diesel fumes and charred steel. Philip watched the entire show from the doorway, and when approached by one of the vendeurs, stammered something about shopping for his mother. Sally agreed to have dinner with him, although she never really ate during the couture season. It was the beginning of an affair that had carried her headlong to this final night, the empty chair across the snowy linen, the curious gaze of the Paris streets, a meeting with a member of the firm, he'd said, and something had gone wrong. Philip, she thought, fear knifing jaggedly through her. Philip. She'd hung on all winter and spring in her apartment in the Latin Quarter, believing the news would change, hostilities would end, Hitler would go away. She rehearsed the truths Coco had taught her over the past 3 years, her inner voice less cultivated and more Western. Raise the waist in front and a girl looks taller. Lower the back and you hide a drooping ass. Dip the hemline in the rear because it'll hitch up along the hips. Everything's in the shoulders. A woman should cross her arms when her measurements are taken. That way she allows for enough give. He lived just off Rue de Rivoli, where it met Rue Saint-Honoré, an old limestone pile arranged around a courtyard, a tall double doorway flung open all day. Some dead aristocrat's hôtel particulier, long since sliced into flats. Not a fashionable address, but Philip was too young and too foreign to know that. He wanted the heart of Paris, a view of the river from his salon, the cries of the knife grinders beneath his window, church bells crashing into his bed at all hours of the night, cracked boiserie and parquet that screamed underfoot, mirrors so fogged they resembled pewter. Sally had lived in Paris longer, but Philip loved the city better, loved the heartiness of her food and the guttural accents and the bird cages on the Ile Saint-Louis. Sunday mornings the two of them threw open the shutters and leaned on the window-sills, their shoulders suspended over the street, staring out at the world until their eyes ached. She had 4 blocks still to walk when she saw the phalanx of cars from the Préfecture de Police. Philip's double-doored entry sprawled wide. Catching up her gas mask and silk dress, she began to run in the vicious sandals, straps cutting into her feet. He was tied to the mahogany bedposts by his wrists and ankles. Blood spattered the length of his nude body. She stood in the bedroom doorway, swaying slightly, the police still unaware of her presence, and studied him. Slack mouth, startled gray eyes, the latticework of ribs too embarrassingly white. The armpits, monkey-like, the gourd of the hips and the knot of pubic hair at the groin, glistening with wetness, the erection still flagrant, even in death. Philip's penis, alert and red, something she touched once in a car, the whip forgotten on the rug beneath him. There was another man, also nude, but a stranger to her, dangling from the chandelier. His toes were horribly calloused, the joints blistered yellow. Her mouth twisted, and she must have gasped something in English, Philip's name possibly, because one of the official French turned his head sharply and saw her, incongruous in her shocking pink gown. He scowled and crossed the room in 3 strides, blocking her view.
"Out, mademoiselle."
"But I know him."
"I'm sorry, mademoiselle. You cannot be here. Antoine, vite."
She was grasped by the arm, not ungently, and led from the apartment, past the divan on which they'd had quick suppers, past the shutters they'd thrown open, a pair of highball glasses half filled with drink. The wastebasket had overturned, and a few shards of glass were scattered on the threadbare Aubusson. She was dragged beyond the obscene figure dangling from the chandelier and into the hallway, where she began to shudder uncontrollably, and the young man, Antoine, he wore a regular gendarme's uniform, not a detective's khaki raincoat, stood uncertainly clutching her elbow.
"Sally."
The quiet voice was one she knew, Max Shoup, who ran SNC's Paris office, in his elegant French clothes, his eyes remote and expressionless. They would have called Max, of course. She turned to him as a small child turns its face into its mother's apron, whimpering, her eyes scrunched closed.
"Sally,"
Max said again, and put an awkward hand on her bare shoulder.
"I'm sorry. I wish you hadn't seen that."
"Philip."
"He's dead, Sally. He's dead."
"But how?" She pushed Shoup away, eyes open now and staring directly at him. "What in the world?"
"The police think it was a heart attack."
He was uncomfortable with the words and all that had not been said, the meaning of the whip, the determined tumescence. 2 men dead with a simultaneity that suggested climax. But Max Shoup was not the kind to admit discomfort. He maintained a perfect gravity, his face as expressionless as though he'd commented upon the weather.
"Who?"
she said with difficulty.
"Is hanging from the ceiling."
Shoup's eyes slid away under their heavy lids.
"I'm told he's from one of the clubs in Montmartre. Did you know about Philip?"
"That he was... that he..."
She stopped, uncertain of the words.
"My poor girl."
Lips compressed, he led her away from the flat, toward the concierge rooms, 1 floor below. The good stiff shot of brandy that would be waiting there.
"It's not..."
she insisted clearly as he paused before the old woman's door, his hand raised to knock.
"What you think, you know. It's not what you think."
Chapter 2. The review at the Folie Bergère didn't end until midnight, so Memphis never made it to the Alibi Club until 1 o'clock in the morning. Spatz knew exactly how the routine would go. The limousine and driver, the boy with the jaguar on its leash, Raoul hovering like a pimp in the background, his hands never far from his wife's ass.
and Memphis herself, taller than a normal Parisienne, thinner and tauter, the muscles under the dark green velvet gown as coiled and sleek as the big cat beside her. She would pause in the curtained doorway as though searching the crowd. The Alibi Club was a true boîte de nuit, a box of a room holding maybe 10 tables, and the effect would be instantaneous. Every head would turn, every man and woman would rise and applaud her again for the simple fact of her existence, for the whiff of exotic sex she brought into the place, of jealousy unappeased. Spatz had seen it all before, month after month of his enslavement to Memphis, which had endured somewhat longer, he reflected, than most of his amusements. He was content to sit alone, nursing a cigar, a plate of hideously overpriced oysters untouched before him. Hundreds of people lined up outside the Alibi Club, but only 40 would be ushered through the entrance ropes, and only Spatz was given a table in a corner by himself. Spatz's careless patronage paid the bills. The fact that he was German and officially an enemy of everyone in the room was immaterial. The man's French was perfect. He drew no attention at all. He was a broad-shouldered, elegantly clad animal of the highest pedigree, Hans Gunther von Dinklage, coddled son of a mixed parentage, child of Lower Saxony, blonde and inhumanly charming. Spatz meant sparrow in German. The name did not immediately suit him until one understood his habit of darting from perch to perch, whim to whim. His official title during the past few years was diplomat, attached to the German embassy, but the embassy was closed now because of the state of war, and Spatz was at loose ends. He had spent the winter in Switzerland, but had drifted back to Paris as the guest of a cousin who lived in the 16th arrondissement. His wife he had divorced years ago on the grounds of incompatibility. His enemies pointed out that she had Jewish blood. He had done nothing of real note in all his 45 years except play polo well at Deauville. A girl in fishnet tights was passing gin, but Spatz preferred scotch. He had just palmed the heavy glass, feeling its weight as a comfort in the hand, when a man slid into the empty seat beside him.
"This is a private table." "I don't care," the man snapped. "I've been hunting you for hours, von Dinklage. You're ridiculously hard to find."
Spatz considered him, fussy and small, with a toothbrush mustache and the sort of clothes that proclaimed the high-paid clerk, the sharp, wet eyes of a blackmailer. He thought he could put a name to the man.
"You're Morris," he mused. "Emery Morris. Am I right? You work for old Cromwell's outfit over near the Ritz." "Sullivan and Cromwell," Morris corrected. "The New York law firm. I'm a partner there. Call me tomorrow at home. I don't do business here."
Emery Morris glanced around the room with a moue of distaste.
"You'll have to make an exception. There is a matter of the gravest importance."
But Spatz was ignoring him. He'd risen to his feet, his bird-like gaze fixed on the curtained doorway and the tall black goddess framed in the swinging curtains. Memphis had arrived.
"What the hell you mean Jaco's not here?"
She breathed through her smile, her gap-toothed smile, practiced noon and night in the huge gilt mirror that hung in her salon off the Rue des Trois Frères, her dusky face melting into the shadows. She didn't care who saw her miming for the mirror, naked in the full-length glass, turning while maybe Raoul or somebody else looked on.
"I'm just a little black gal from the hills of Tennessee. I don't know how I'm going to survive in this big old white town. You think I should go in whiteface and make the Frenchies do like Memphis? Everybody wearing whiteface all the time like we're going to die of hunger and cold one day?"
"I told you," Raoul muttered,
fingers nervous in his pockets, face twisted in a grin. It was the carnival barker grin of a man who pulled the strings, except only Memphis decided who held the end of her rope, and it hadn't been Raoul for a long, long time.
"He never showed up, baby. Let's make the rounds and go. My skin's crawling just standing here. We got a train to catch."
"I ain't going nowhere,"
she murmured, her eyes on a bald man sitting in the front row, his look foolish as a bloodhound's, one of her regulars. She thought his name was Monsieur Duplix.
"I'm going to do my show."
She swayed her long body in Duplix's general direction
and smoothed his domed head with her gloved hands, crooning something her mama taught her years ago.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?